here at home, the coming months will be another season of homecomings. Across America, our servicemen and women will be reunited with their families. Today, I can say that our troops in Iraq will definitely be home for the holidays.
That's President Obama announcing the withdrawal of all U.S. troops from Iraq. By year's end, 40,000 American soldiers and Marines will have returned from the war. How do they adjust to civilian life afterward? In some cases, multiple deployments to a war zone. And how will the rest of us back home respond to them and their needs? Later on, we're going to talk with a suicide prevention coordinator at the Chalmers P. Wiley VA Medical Center. We'll also talk to a municipal court judge who introduced the first veterans court in Ohio. Joining us now is Tony Perry, the San Diego bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Tony has traveled seven times each to cover the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he writes about the troops at the Marine Corps Base Camp Pendleton in San Diego. Welcome to the show, Tony Perry.
Good to be here.
For our listeners, are you among those who have returned from Iraq, or are you a relative or friend of someone who has or will return by year's end when the drawdown from Iraq is complete? Give us a call. Give us a call and tell us what you're doing to prepare or what you've learned since the return of your friend or family member. Yes, Tony.
I'm certainly a friend of those that are coming home. I'm not one of them myself.
Right.
I made a quick trip to Afghanistan earlier in the year, and I'll be going back to Afghanistan sometime next year.
You've covered Marines serving in Iraq and Afghanistan and at Camp Pendleton. So you've been with soldiers at war and at home. What are they talking about in terms of this drawdown and the prospect of so many returning home? Not everybody will, but so many will.
Well, for the Marines, of course, coming out of Iraq means going to Afghanistan. There's really been no lull in the fighting as it regards Marines from Camp Pendleton since 2001. They were the first conventional troops into Afghanistan in 2001, the first conventional troops into Iraq in 2003, and now they're heavily involved in Afghanistan. So it's been 10 years of constant war for the Marines from Camp Pendleton, and also we have another large base out here, 29 Palms.
A CBS poll released earlier this month showed that 77% of Americans, including 63% of all Republicans, approve of the plan to withdraw the troops from Iraq by year's end. Is that the case for military personnel, to your knowledge?
You know, I don't know a scientific study, but I did a round of interviews when the president made his announcement, and I think service personnel are split just like the American people. A lot of people say, good, we should be coming out. We've gone, we've suffered, we've sacrificed, and we've achieved a lot there. Time to come home and let the Iraqis. Others say we're coming home too prematurely. Others are just not sure what this complex world is going to mean. So the military is not monolithic, and they're often just as divided and all over the place on their opinions as the civilian community.
Leo in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Leo. Hello, Leo. Lost Leo. A recent Time magazine cover story reports that the U.S. military and American society are drifting apart, that we now have a professional military of volunteers that at war now for more than a decade, and that the lack of sacrifice, and not even that, but just the lack of connection with the military has created a gap that is going to change how we accept them when they return.
I think that's probably true. We have these Occupy movements all over the country, and the rallying cry is the 1% versus the 99%. They mean it in an economic way. But if you look at military service, really 1% of Americans are serving and sacrificing, and the other 99% of us are not. Now, that said, I think the nation has grown up, has matured since Vietnam, and we no longer take out on the warriors whatever disagreements we may have about the war itself. That's a sign of maturity and progress, but you're right. Warriors coming home, Marines, soldiers, sailors, Air Force, Coast Guard, they're going to find a world that doesn't really understand what it is they do and how they do it. And there may be a certain compassion collapse after the troops come home and it's all uh, it's all quiet again as far as the civilian community. So we'll have to see in terms of employment, in terms of standing behind them on budgetary matters about mental health and rehabilitation and things like that. It's the great unanswered question as we stand here today. Just how are we going to treat these returning warriors?
To what extent, I mean, because of all the deployments, the redeployments that so many of them have gone through, how does that change the nature of how they're viewing the war versus, say, the one-year stints that so many people did in Vietnam?
Remember, of course, in Vietnam there was a draft, and
right.
these young men, young women are all volunteers. And particularly in the Marine Corps, they knew when they enlisted, most of them, that they were going to deploy. Now, that doesn't make it any less stressful on mm-hmm. them and their loved ones, but they did know what they were getting into. So that's different, considerably different than Vietnam. The continual deployments has ratcheted up the stress level on the Marines and their families. But so far, the various metrics that are used to gauge these things would suggest that they've come through at this point rather well. All sorts of family readiness programs have been put in place, a great big new hospital at Camp Pendleton, a wounded warrior barracks, a big facility called a Hope and Care Center. They really tried to step up as best they could. Is it going to be enough? We don't know. After the shooting stops in Iraq and hopefully someday in Afghanistan, that doesn't mean the war for those who fought it ends. In many ways, it only begins really as they come home and try and pick up their lives, either continuing in the military service or in civilian life.
My guest is Tony Perry, the San Diego Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. He covers Camp Pendleton in San Diego. If you have a question or comment for him about the returning troops regarding the drawdown in Iraq, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Leo in Columbus, are you there?
Yes, ma'am, I'm here.
All righty. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Listen, I really wish the colonel was back on because I had a couple things to say to him, but in lieu of that, I'm a Vietnam veteran. I wasn't drafted. I volunteered. I was an operations specialist for 3 years. When I came back to Columbus 2 days after I left inland, in country, and I had to take my uniform off at the airport, I would have been mobbed. Now, there's a major difference because they're saying that most of the people that went overseas now elected to. I have to correct that by saying most of them were National Guardsmen. They didn't know they were going overseas, okay? 30 and 40-year-old guys that had been in service here in this country were not aware they were going to be activated and put into harm's way. It's called the National Guard, not the International Guard. Anyway, I hope and pray that the troops coming home are welcomed much better than the Korean or Vietnam veterans ever were. You know, it's true that the war never ends for us. It will never end for them. That's just a fact.
Well, Leo, let me ask you, I mean, just as it stands now, is there any reason for you to believe that they're not being embraced?
No, there's okay. No reason for me to believe that. I'd like to see them march down New York Street, in the cities in New York, and be ticker taped. I mean, that's how they'd be welcomed, with open arms everywhere and in show, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody needs to show how welcome they are and how much they appreciate it. Even though it was a wrongful thing, after we found out, it was too late. They're there.
You know, Tony Perry, and thank you very much, Leo, for hanging in there with us on that. Tony Perry, there is a, beyond the separation, the fact that they're all volunteer and that they've been redeployed there many times, and there's this kind of this gap between them and the rest of the country. You cover a military base. To what extent do those military bases insulate the families and the troops from what's going on out here?
Oh, to a great degree, certainly at Camp Pendleton, which is a gated community, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Let me jump on something Leo said. Leo is exactly right. A lot of the troops were National Guard troops who never thought they would deploy out of this country, thought that they would be involved with maybe riot control or humanitarian relief after a big flood, and they do marvelous work in this country. They never thought they would deploy, but they have deployed both the Iraq and Afghanistan campaigns could not have been prosecuted without the National Guard and the Air National Guard. In some ways, it's a kind of backdoor draft in which we take people who did not think that they would be deploying and deploy them. And they've also seen a high percentage, a much higher percentage in some ways, of these folks suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury, and some other other problems, higher than those who did enlist Marines, Army, as infantry grunts and knew and wanted to deploy. So that's another issue that has to be dealt with. There is a tendency sometimes in our civilian community to think of the military as monolithic. It isn't. Each individual segment, Army, Marine Corps, National Guard, Navy, Air Force, is its own community with its own culture and its own mission and its own pluses and minuses. And I think the National Guard folks need probably in some ways, pound for pound, more assistance when they get home than folks who enlisted knowing that they were going to go into combat. On the issue of the insulation, mm-hmm. it's significant. Camp Pendleton, for example, where there are 42,000 active duty personnel and several tens of thousands of family members, and then even more than that, civilian employees, is a world unto itself. Even though it's right near the city of Oceanside, it really is a world away. It really is symbolic in many ways of the split between the military and the civilian community. They're there. They're close to us. We see them, but they're from a different community and a different culture as we move into what are we now into our fourth decade of all volunteer, where we've really outsourced, if you will, national security to a group that signs up for it, while the rest of us get the benefits of what it is they're doing.
And the military, the Pentagon is in budget cutting moves, has shut down a lot of different bases, and most of them, really all except for in Washington State, are located in the South. And beyond the fact that they're all getting spoiled by that great weather, to what extent does that kind of separate the military from the rest of us up here in the not such great weather?
Well, you're right. Military bases are not equally spread across the country, so there isn't a sense of the military being part of all of our communities. They tend to be in the South, tend to be in the Southwest. The Marine Corps is here in Southern California. It's also in North Carolina, South Carolina, and it's also, of course, in Hawaii and Japan. And that, too, is a certain alienation, if you will, when you can meet whole groups of people, journalists even, not a single one of them has a family member serving, and not a single one of them actually knows someone currently serving in uniform. Now, down the road, is that going to make our foreign policy different? I don't know. Certainly, we've been very, very sensitive to the mounting fatalities in a way that you might think we wouldn't be since it was all volunteer. So I think we may be a little too apoplectic about the idea that the military is separating from the overall society, because I don't think people are at all blasé about these horrible numbers, what we've seen both in Iraq and Afghanistan. What are we at, 6,200 dead Americans, 10 times that many wounded. People are still heartsick about that, even though there is not a draft and your young nephew is not in danger of getting drafted and sent somewhere he doesn't want to go.
My guest is Tony Perry. He's a San Diego bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. He covers Camp Pendleton. He's traveled to Iraq and Afghanistan to cover the wars there as well. He will return when we return, and also joining us will be Suicide Prevention Coordinator Bernard Williams from the Chalmers P. Wiley Veterans Affairs Ambulatory Care Center right here in Columbus. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Weekday mornings, prepare for the day with NPR's Steve Inskeep and Renee Montaigne, and hear local news updates from the award-winning WOSU News Team. Listen to Morning Edition weekdays from 5 until 9 a.m. on 89.7 NPR News.
Checking the weather on this last day of November 2011, cloudy skies that are gradually becoming sunny. A high expected to be about 39 degrees. Tonight, mostly clear. The overnight low will be 26 degrees. Then on Thursday, sunny. Tomorrow's high, 46. Thursday night, mostly clear and a low around 31 degrees. And then on Friday, partly sunny skies are expected and hoped for, and a high of 43 degrees. Right now, we have 35 degrees at our studios here in the Fawcett Center on the OSU campus.
Support for 89.7 comes from the historic Midland Theater in Newark, presenting Gospel and Grammy Award winner Sandy Patty and her Yuletide celebration, Thursday, December 8th at 7:30 p.m. Tickets at midlandtheater.org.
Welcome back. We're talking about now, getting a little bit more personal about the drawdown in Iraq. What happens when soldiers and Marines and the rest of our military personnel return from these wars today on all sides? How will they adjust to civilian life? How are we ready to meet their needs? Still with us is Tony Perry, the San Diego Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. He's covered the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the troops at Marine Corps Base Camp Pendleton in San Diego. Joining us now is Bernard Williams. He's Suicide Prevention Coordinator at the Chalmers P. Wiley VA Ambulatory Care Center here in Columbus. Welcome to the show, Bernard.
Thank you. Good morning.
The rates of suicide in the United States Army began to rise in 2004 and continued climbing until 2010. And then the suicide rate in the active duty finally started to level off, which is, you know, a relatively good thing, but continues to rise in the National Guard soldiers. So it remains twice as high as it was prior to the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Has the military been doing enough to recognize and deal with the problem of soldier suicides? And I ask you that of you, Tony Perry, from your reporting, what's your take on that?
The Marine Corps has done a lot. Enough, that's a hard one to judge. I know the numbers are going to be down this year over last year, and that's a sign of progress. But I think it's a day-to-day, case-by-case issue. The repeated deployments are an issue. The loneliness when you deploy is an issue. Suicides, the Marines will tell you, happen when they first deploy, when they get to Afghanistan, when they get to Iraq, and when they're coming home and they're overcome by certain feelings. It's a battle, and it's going to take a lot more effort going forward as they come home, as maybe they start to deal with these so-called silent wounds of PTSD and traumatic brain injury, not to mention family problems and employment problems. Again, when the shooting stops, that doesn't mean the war stops for these folks. And suicide, which is a major problem with all of a certain demographic, young men of a certain age, mm-hmm. Civilian or military, is one of those things that we're going to have to grapple with, continue to grapple with.
Bernard Williams, were you a suicide prevention coordinator before the war started?
No, I was not. I came on board around 2007.
Okay, when they started to finally, that's kind of a judgmental thing, but when they started to implement new policies.
Correct.
Tell us what's the difference between 2007 and now 2011?
One of the things that we're doing now in 2007 is that we're tracking more veterans that are depressed. One of the things that we have now is a high-risk list in the VA. So we have a high-risk list that track veterans that have either made a suicide attempt or have had some serious thoughts of suicide that resulted in a hospitalization. So we have a high-risk list. The high-risk list within the VA system is not to put the veteran on the spot, but what we're doing in this particular situation is that we're alerting all of the providers within the local VA system that this veteran has made a suicide attempt or has, you know, either had some suicidal thinking that resulted in a hospitalization. In this way, what we're doing, the providers are aware, because most veterans who have made a suicide attempt or completion weren't seen in mental health, but were seen in some other area. So this way, the provider, as well as the clerks, or anybody that has contact with the veteran, is able to talk to the veteran about depression or what's going on with him or her.
Now, the issue of mental health and mental illness has been a very touchy one in the military, and the Marines are known even more for appearing even more stoic in this case. What do we know, Tony Perry, about the Marines and how they're managing it?
They start talking in boot camp, where you have those 19-year-olds with the shaved heads, and they get them up at 5 in the morning and run them ragged all day. Mm-hmm. They start in boot camp saying, take care of your buddy. If you see him going down, if you see him talking, I don't have anything to live for, if you see him moaning about some girl that isn't isn't quite as enamored of him as she as he is of her. Talk to him, talk it up the chain of command, and that continues all the way through the battlefields of Iraq and Afghanistan, and when they come home. And also, making an attempt to take the stigma away. As you point out, the Marines tend to be Spartan-esque in their culture, and for a long period of time, there was a sense that only weaklings, only sissies ask for counseling. They're chipping away at that because it's just simply not true. And a lot of lectures, a lot of counseling, a lot of professional help through the chaplains, through the medical folks. Enough? Again, you know, we'll have to see long term. The numbers are down this year, but this is the tyranny of small numbers. It could be up next year, it could be down. It's, again, one of these things you got to work at all day, every day.
Yeah, and down from what? Because they're still higher than they were before the war.
They are, although they are, I believe, going to be lower than the demographic in the civilian community. Again, suicide for young men between 18 and 28 is, I think, the second leading cause of death. So young men, civilians, commit suicide at a troubling rate. In the military, where you're under a great deal of stress and pressure and where you have weapons close by, it's not surprising that you'd have a number somewhat similar, a little higher. Now, they had prided themselves for a long period of time that their numbers were lower than the civilians. Then it popped up higher even than the Army, but now they're working on it and getting it down. Is it because they found a formula? I don't know. Is it just because this year is different than last year and next year will be wholly different? Again, you know, there isn't a one-size-fits-all. There's no sort of killing Hitler in his bunker and the war is over kind of thing, right, when it comes to dealing with these post-combat issues.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but when the folks are returning from the Vietnam War, the economy was a little bit better off. Now, I might be wrong about that, but this is the worst economy we've had since the Depression, so it had to be better off than we are now. We have an email from a listener. They write, I lived on Camp Pendleton for 5 years. How is the Department of Defense going to help make sure troops can find jobs and relocate somewhere where there are jobs? Many Marines stay in California and are unable to get jobs and become homeless, or if they return, it is a depressed area.
And that's going to be very, very difficult. And you add yet another factor. That is that all the military services are decreasing their numbers. The Navy is going to go down. The Marine Corps, Army are going to go down as we try to shrink the federal budget. So you come back from combat. You come back from a forward deployment, possibly with PTSD, possibly with marital issues. And suddenly this career you thought you were going to have, and maybe you'd become a sergeant or a staff sergeant, oops, no room for you. That's going to increase the stress. I know they're scrambling now to do more outsourcing, but very difficult, very, very hard to find jobs for folks when there just aren't enough jobs for anybody out there at the moment.
Also joining us right now, Sherry Erickson-Young. She's a case manager at the Chalmers B. Wiley Ambulatory Care Center. She's one of two case managers at the facility and provides treatment to soldiers at risk. Welcome to the show, Sherry.
Thank you. Good morning.
To what extent does the economy affect the mood and the circumstances, the emotional circumstances of the folks that you're working with?
It does very much. Frequently when veterans come to our walk-in clinic with suicidal ideations, it does have to do with financial issues in their life. You know, it's a big issue for a lot of them that come through.
So what when they do have problems and they're worried about getting a job, or they've lost their job and the slot's not open for them when they're coming back, what do you tell them? Where do they go?
We try to provide them with a lot of support. That's the main thing that we do for them. And there are organizations within the community that can provide some financial support. And we also have staff members that can actually assist them in looking for work.
You know, Tony Perry, I'm thinking about people who just lose their jobs and feel like they're sort of flailing out there and unconnected or disconnected with everything else. To what extent do you see that more or less in the military with people who are completely part of something? You know, as we were talking about that insulation on top of everything else.
It's going to be very difficult. People who were part of an organization that they believed in, that empowered them, that reinforce them as competent people, and then suddenly they're not part of it any longer. And that's going to be very, very difficult. Everybody knows about people who have retired after 20 years, and suddenly they're at their belly up to the bar at the non-commissioned officers club at 10:30 in the morning. That's a problem, and they're going to have to deal with it. The VA will have to step up. There was a very troubling story in the USA Today this morning about the VA being swamped by veterans coming home with post-traumatic stress disorder. Again, there's a tidal wave out there of veterans who are going to have to look to both the VA and the private resources, public resources, and the community at large. And the question is, are we going to be up to it, particularly in this terrible economy, particularly as we try to shrink the size of the federal budget? It's going to be as difficult, I believe, as the combat was in Iraq and Afghanistan in terms of finding the right strategy, staying on it, funding it, changing strategies if this one isn't working, and moving forward. Just today, there's a big seminar going on in San Diego with the Navy medical people, Marine people, all sorts of private specialists. Wounded warrior care, where do we go from here? We've brought them home, we've patched them up, but that's not the end of it. There's a lot more work to be done.
Bernard Williams, are you feeling that tidal wave?
We are. One of the things that we've done, we've stepped up a lot in many areas that we have. Now we have post-traumatic stress disorder teams. In other words, there's psychologists, social workers, and, you know, physician psychiatrists that work on that team to work with veterans that are, you know, that are diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. We also have vocational rehab program within the VA. We have compensated work therapy. And we also have supportive employment for veterans that are, you know, we're trying to place veterans that are unemployed.
And there are a lot, even more so than the Vietnam War, which was even better than the previous wars, there are a lot of wounded returning, which is a good thing because they survived, but their wounds are horrible in some cases. How does that play into what you do in terms of suicide prevention?
Part of it, you know, many of the veterans that are, you know, on our high risk for suicide prevention are, you know, dealing with chronic pain, dealing with other, you know, issues that are a result of the war. We have several things that, you know, that are in place to deal with veterans who are wounded. You know, many of them are, you know, are compensated because, you know, it was service connected. We also, with veterans just coming into the VA system, we have our Operation Enduring Freedom, Operation Iraqi Freedom. This is, it kind of shortcuts the veterans enrollment process. They're working, they can go directly work with the OAF, you know, worker and get integrated right into the VA system.
Number is 614-292-8513. If you have a question for any of our guests, Tony Perry, San Diego Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times, and also Bernard Williams from the Chalmers P. Wiley Veterans Affairs Ambulatory Care Center. Got to shorten the name of that someday. He is the coordinates of suicide prevention there. And with him, Sherry Erickson-Young. She's a case manager at the Chalmers P. Wiley Center. So give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're, Bernard, part of a national tracking and trending program to enable the VA to learn more about at-risk veterans and to provide more targeted interventions. Once you get the answers to those questions, is the military prepared to pay for the answers, to pay for, you know, what you'll learn from them?
Are you talking about my outreach with the military?
Yes, because we're talking about the military cutting back, and Tony's made the point that there's going to be more need than ever. Do you feel cutbacks? Do you feel pinched?
At this point, I don't. I don't feel, you know, cutbacks or pinched at this particular time. One of the things I said is earlier, you know, we are providing intervention within the VA system so that all, you know, all providers will feel comfortable in talking to the veterans, you know, about suicide prevention because of the amount of veterans that are returning. We want to make sure that everyone feels comfortable and everyone's prepared to work with our veterans.
And what about the families, Tony? How well are they prepared at Camp Pendleton to help manage this along with the VA?
Well, it's a stress, of course. One thing the Marine Corps did early on in the Iraq War, they realized the old system of what they called family readiness, where an overworked sergeant would hand out a list of phone numbers to the wives and say, here, if you have a problem, call one of these folks, that really was inadequate. That there was a survey done of families, spouses, mostly wives, and it was a cry for help. that they felt overwhelmed by the stress of having a loved one at war and with all the problems on the home front that they had to deal with alone. So what the Marine Corps did was professionalize the Family Readiness Officer program. They hired 141 of them for the 55,000 Marines in Southern California and Arizona, and that has been a great help. Perfect? Absolutely not. Are there still wives that feel isolated and alone? Absolutely, particularly those possibly that don't live on base or close to a base. But they have come a long way in this conflict, in this decade, from the old system of if the Marine Corps wanted you to have a wife, it would have given you one. Have they done enough? We'll see. But I think there is outreach there. There are services there. When they get in financial problems, when they get loneliness problems, substance abuse problems, there are services there. Will they reach out for them? I don't know. Marine Corps has just also sort of amped up its alcoholism prevention and work program, because they know that a lot of the problems, marital problems, driving problems, work problems, are alcohol-related, and they've amped that program up. Again, when the war ends, the warriors are still fighting.
Sherry Erickson-Young, to what extent do you involve the family in your treatment?
The VA actually has a provider whose sole task as the family services coordinator is to provide support and education to family members. And in fact, the veteran doesn't need to be enrolled in our system for family members to receive that support. And in general, providers are throughout the VA are encouraged to include family members in therapy and in treatment for our veterans. We see them as being very important in providing care for our veterans.
Susan, you're on the air from Columbus. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
I just called because I would say that I don't support the troops. And I think a lot of people are just phonies.
What do you mean you say you don't support the troops? What do you mean by that?
I want to preface it by saying that I know quite a few Vietnam vets, and I like them. I think they're nice, intelligent people. But even though a lot of them are very active in the veteran community, they never had anything good to say about Vietnam. And I didn't support the invasion of Iraq, because I always felt like it was about gasoline.
Right. So we've talked about that already, but you don't support individuals who have gone over and served in Iraq and Afghanistan, and you're saying people who say they do, you think they're phonies?
Well, I think a lot of people, like I talked to a guy down the street, way back, and, you have to kind of qualify it between now and the early years of the war. When I talked to a guy down the street a few years ago, he was like all gung-ho about the war because he wanted cheap gas for his car. So okay. I'd say he was a little less phony.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Susan. So what?
Well, I don't support the military. I mean, I support it because I have to, because I pay taxes.
Okay.
But I'd rather ride a bus or take a train than support this huge military complex that goes in and, invades these countries.
Well, let's let the folks here respond to that. Thanks a lot, Susan, for your call. Bernard Williams, is there any way to prepare people for negative reactions, or is this really not much of an issue?
I haven't seen it as much of an issue. I don't hear a lot of our troops that are returning right, at now complain about negative reactions that they've received.
Mm-hmm. Do you get anything like that, Sherry Erickson-Young, in your work?
I haven't seen too many veterans talking about, being treated poorly in the community at this point. I imagine, of course, it's possible, but we haven't seen very much of it.
And Tony Puri, from where you sit, has there been much of a problem in negative reactions to the troops from people like Susan?
Yeah, certainly nothing like the Vietnam War. And all those stories of soldiers, Marines having to, take off their uniforms and put their civvies on quick so no one would know they're in the military. Nothing at all like that. And, of course, this is a military community. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I have talked to Marine spouses who feel a certain estrangement when they talk to civilians, that civilians don't really understand what it is their husbands do, that civilians may think of them as victims. Oh, my goodness, it's awful. Your husband is deployed. And a Marine spouse told me, you know, we're proud of our husband's deploying. So there is that estrangement, but it's very small, very discreet, as opposed to that animosity that we saw during the Vietnam War. Now, what you get, I think, is a lot of people saying almost like rote, thank you for your service. It started to become, you know, one of these hot enough for you kind of statements that people make without a lot of thought.
Or cold enough for you in the North. So
indeed.
Okay.
But better that than nothing, but okay, thank you for your service. Are you going to be there when Congress goes to cut the funds for PTSD or traumatic brain injury or any of this research or the VA? Are you going to be there talking to your representative? We'll see.
Well, we're going to be joined in a few minutes by Mansfield Municipal Court Judge Jerry Ault. I want to say thanks to Bernard Williams right now for joining us for this segment. Thanks, Bernard.
Thank you for having me.
And also Sherry Erickson-Young. Thanks for joining us, Sherry.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Bernard Williams, he's Suicide Prevention Coordinator from the Chalmers P. Wiley Veterans Affairs Ambulatory Care Center right here in Columbus. And Sherry Erickson-Young works there with him as a case manager. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
GPSs that track our every movement, brain scans that can more or less read our minds. On the next Fresh Air, how new technology is challenging our notions of constitutional values like privacy and freedom of speech. We talk with Jeffrey Rosen, co-editor of the new book, Constitution 3.0, Freedom and Technological Change. Join us.
Terry Gerson, Fresh Air, coming your way in just about 15 minutes at 12 noon, right here on 89.7 NPR News. The weatherman says that we will have a high today of about 39 degrees, clear tonight, and a low about 26. Then on Thursday, sunny, tomorrow's high 46, a little warmer at night too, a low of 31. Then by Friday, partly sunny, and a high of 43 degrees. And right now we have 35 degrees at our studios here on the OSU campus. On Friday, December the 9th at 5 p.m., WOSU Public Media will no longer broadcast on 820 a.m. To hear national news from NPR and local news from our award-winning news team, tune to 89.7 FM. On 89.7 NPR News, you can hear your favorite shows like Morning Edition, All Sides with Ann Fisher, and you can stream 89.7 on your computer or mobile device. Just visit WOSU.org. And be sure to set your radio dial to 89.7 FM after Friday, December the 9th. Coming up at noon, it'll be Fresh Air with Terry Gross here at 89.7 FM.
Today on All Sides, we're talking about the end of the war in Iraq from the point of view of the soldiers and the Marines who are returning. How will they adjust to civilian life? And are we ready to meet their needs? Still with us is Tony Perry, the San Diego Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. He's covered the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the troops at Marine Corps Base Camp Pendleton in San Diego. Joining us now is Mansfield Municipal Court Judge Jerry Ault. Judge Ault is the first municipal court judge in the United States to conduct four specialty dockets, a drug and alcohol treatment court, a mental health court, a domestic violence court, and most recently, a veterans court. Welcome to the show, Judge.
Good morning.
The Mansfield Municipal Veterans Court is the first in Ohio and one of the first in the U.S. Why a specialty docket court for veterans?
Well, we found with the special dockets that putting people together who share like problems and that come from like situations often helps people to recover better from drug and alcohol addiction and get back into for the vet civilian life with less problems.
You set up a separate city court just for veterans. Is there alternative sentencing associated with that?
Indeed, it is an alternative sentencing. Not every veteran is put into veterans court. It's those who are suffering from the most severe issues, who are repeat offenders in the court, and who need treatment generally.
Tony Perry, has crime been an issue with those returning?
It has, of course. I mean, I would call it less crime than sort of misbehavior, acting out, traffic problems, and things of that nature. San Diego County does have a veterans court. Now, there's only a select group that qualify for that, to go through that process. None of those that are accused of violent crimes or sex crimes. They must also be in a program to try and treat their underlying causes, be they depression, alcohol, drugs, whatever, and then they have to submit to counseling and screening. So it isn't a get out of jail free card for a veteran who's done more serious crimes or refuses to get in a program to get straight. But it is very successful. It's getting larger. Each year, for example, we have what they call a stand down for all veterans, homeless veterans. And mm-hmm. they come in and get all sorts of counseling and clothing. And it's a very successful, began in San Diego, has moved across the country. And one of the more successful things is a quickie court to try and get some of these folks, get these traffic issues taken care of, maybe some warrants, and in some cases, child support. They work with them to try and get them back sort of within the framework of society. But the Veterans Court is every Friday or every other Friday, and it's very successful, and they're hoping to expand it. But again, it's selective and who they'll take in.
Judge Ault, what about your court? What kind of crimes qualify? Who do you see there?
Well, I'm a misdemeanor court, so I don't deal with the most serious violent and sexual mm-hmm. crimes. So we interview each individual who qualifies, and we make our decisions on a case-by-case basis. But everyone that does qualify, again, goes into treatment and meets every other week with the court.
Since the Mansfield courts opened, at least 46 others have followed in 20 states around the country. And Tony Perry just mentioned San Diego. It's very successful. More courts are in the works, including a possible veterans court in Franklin County. They say the details haven't been finalized. And I know, Tony, that's really interesting about the stand down. We have a very successful stand down here as well, but I don't think it involves a court. So that's kind of interesting. Judge, how does the court operate now compared to the way you envisioned it? And how would you like to see it change, or what are your hopes and dreams for the concept, I guess?
Right now, the only change I would make is I hope to be able to expand as the need is generated. I think we're doing an excellent job. We're getting great, great response from the veterans. It's the only court I've ever been involved in where everybody calls me sir.
You do what you have to do.
Yeah, really. I don't see any necessity for change. We are a model court for the Ohio Supreme Court. We work, anytime I formed a special docket, I work through the Ohio Supreme Court to do it, so we did it by the standards they deemed appropriate.
So how does it start out? Somebody winds up in your court. How does it happen? They're accused of a misdemeanor crime, and in the process of interviewing them after that?
Exactly right. I ask them from the bench. I ask people if they've had military service. I've learned that you don't ask them if they're veterans because of various reasons. They might be too embarrassed to admit it. Some don't feel they're veterans unless they've served in an actual front. But we've been taught just to ask if they have military service. And part of our general questionnaire through the probation department asks the same question. And as the court has developed and become known popularly, or throughout the city, I should say, mm-hmm. Police will inform us if they've arrested somebody they know is a veteran who's coming to the court and they think it might be appropriate. Even citizens let us know.
If you would like to speak with, have a question or comment for either of our guests, Mansfield Municipal Court Judge Jerry Ault and also Tony Perry, San Diego Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Melissa, you're on the air from Columbus. Welcome to the show, Melissa.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Very well. Thank you.
I just wanted to comment from the perspective of the mother of a United States Marine.
Okay.
My son still serves. His contract is up in August, this coming August. And we've had our struggles with his service, both on his side, the military side, and on the civilian side of things, because of people maybe not supporting his service. But I would just like to say that to the people that are listening, I've been on the phone with my son when he's been thousands of miles from me, and I can't really help him other than to talk to him and him talking about wanting to take his own life and the struggles that they face and that they go through are something that we can't understand because we're not in the military, we're not serving. And I would just like to point out that, we're concerned about how he's going to adjust when he comes home. And we're obviously going to do everything we possibly can to help him with that adjustment. And he certainly isn't alone. There's a lot of his friends that are the same way. And I'm really thankful for the people that try to help them as much as they can and for the sacrifices they make and their families make. And I'm really encouraged to hear about the court that, you know, there's going to be, there is a special court to help veterans with the problems that they face when they come home. So I just wanted to comment on that.
Melissa, just from where you sit, are you confident that the Marines are doing enough to help people like your son?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, it seems to be, you know, they seem to be addressing it. Of course, when you're on the phone with him and he's telling you these things, you want to run screaming to the car.
Right.
to drive to help him, you know, or go to the airport and fly as fast as you can and get there and help him. And at that moment, I wish that there was more I could have done or more that they're doing. But I do think that they addressed it. I mean, Marines don't look at each other like it's someone I work with. They look at each other like that's my brother, and they won't leave each other behind. Regardless of what the situation is, they won't turn their backs on each other, and they're responsible for one another. And I mean, they do drill that into them from, you know, boot camp on. And my son feels that very strongly, and I know his friends do too. He's a good boy, and we're very proud of him. And we hear a lot of, you know, really nice comments from people a lot about his service. I have had several, I won't call them run-ins, but discussions with people regarding his service that they don't support it. And he feels that too. He feels like sometimes maybe his decision to join the Marine Corps, which he based on wanting to help other people and protect his country, sometimes he feels like it really wasn't the best decision because he doesn't always feel supported by the general public.
All right. Well, Melissa, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for sharing your story. We appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it. Have a good day.
You too.
Thanks.
Judge Ault, does mental illness play into the role your court plays? I know you have a mental health court too, so.
Yes, yeah. To some degree. I don't know if you consider PTSD or TBI mental illness, but certainly we see a lot of that. It's something that is treatable, of course, and it's one of our goals is to get everybody treated that needs it.
How did you prepare your staff to manage a veterans court versus any others?
Well, as you might know, Justice Stratton from the Ohio Supreme Court is very active in special dockets.
Right.
She's a champion of mental health court dockets, and after the initiative in May of 2009 came down from Washington that the veterans were to establish, the Veterans Association was to establish justice outreach officers, she put together a statewide committee, which I was fortunate enough to be on, to discuss different issues. As a result of that, the state of Ohio has very good training for special dockets, and I had selected an individual I thought appropriate from my probation staff, and then we made sure he had the training necessary.
Tony Perry, you talked about how they start talking about a lot of these issues, the emotional issues and the warning signs and that kind of thing in boot camp. Do they talk about it when they're, you know, when they're sending them back?
Oh, absolutely. There are all sorts of debriefs and sessions as they start to pack up and get on that plane home. Once they get home, and this is new since Afghanistan, after they've had, in Marine case, 7-month deployment, they keep them on the base. That is to say, they don't let them go on leave for, I think, 90 days so that they can be screened, so they can stay together and continue to have that sense of unity, and as Melissa says, that sense of brotherhood, and then they can go on leave. Used to be they would come home, immediately go on leave, and they'd maybe suffer that kind of psychological wrench of being part of a tight-knit, supportive group, brother group, and then suddenly you don't. Well, they realize that's not a smart thing. So they're doing what they can. Is it enough? We'll see. There's still all sorts of motorcycle accidents of young men buying these expensive motorcycles and cracking up within a day or two of coming home. So we'll see. You know, this thing is evolving, and these silent wounds. Now, the judge is exactly right that post-traumatic stress disorder is treatable, and there are studies that show that while you come home and you have the all the matrix with supportive atmosphere, with counseling, with a good family life, you can diffuse that ticking bomb slowly over a period of time. The question is, are we going to have the patience, the money, and the staff, if you will, to do that for large, large numbers of military personnel coming home?
Judge Ault, to what extent is the problem that they're just not used to being out and managing things on their own? Like, it's just the bureaucracy when you're talking about misdemeanors often. They talk about at Ohio State University, some of the veterans that are coming over to Ohio State University, there's just not enough structure for them.
Exactly. And as I think Tony mentioned earlier, most of the crimes we see are acting out crimes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have these problems going on. They're trained to live day by day in a certain way, which is appropriate for Afghanistan, but is not appropriate for civilian life back home. And of course, when they're affected with PTSD or TBI, they often begin self-medicating through alcohol or drugs,
mm-hmm.
and that leads to misdemeanor crimes.
Judge Ault, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it was enjoyable. Appreciate the call. Thank you.
Mansfield Municipal Court Judge Jerry Ault founded the first Veterans Court in Ohio. And also Tony Perry, thanks for spending the hour with us, Tony.
My pleasure.
Tony Perry's a San Diego Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. And everybody out there, thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News. It's a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for the Statehouse News Bureau stories on 89.7 come from the law firm of Porter, Wright, Morris, and Arthur LLP, helping businesses and individuals solve complex legal problems throughout Ohio, across the country, and around the world. On the web at porterwright.com.